in Davao, where knowledge grows.
Up and down the Caribbean chain. The point is that I litigated because I was trying to find out information about how our money was spent. It's the largest amount of public money ever spent in Trinidad and Tobago. We spent virtually $4 billion, a country this big. $4 billion. And that money went to we don't know who. That money went for we don't know why. And all we can get is a speech and a press release. I don't want a speech and a press release. I want the details. I want all the details of all the payments.
Yeah, that's Afro Raymond back in 2015 in a TEDx talk about CL Financial, looking at financial corruption through the prism of race. And I think the salient point there is that $4 billion, which he describes as the largest amount of public money ever spent in this way without any kind of transparency. So we're going to be talking to Afra in a minute. But before we go there, we just want to open the phone line, 622-4911. We know people have been trying to get in on the program to ask questions about the last hour and 15 minutes. So we're going to take perhaps three or four calls very quickly before we turn our attention to Brother Afra Raymond. 622-4911, that's the number to call. If we don't get that call immediately, brothers, we turn our attention to our brother Afra Raymond, and we'll wait for your calls. We'll start taking calls at around 9:30. Okay, so brother Afra, welcome to Indaba.
Thank you. My first time on this program, so I want to thank yourself and Dr. Fergus for inviting me on the program, and good night to all the listeners.
Yes, indeed. Well, let's go straight to the big elephant in the room. Mm-hmm. The $4 billion,
yes,
which you describe as the largest amount of public money ever spent in this company, this country.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about suing government,
yes,
and winning,
yes,
and then something happens.
Well, yeah. Let us start off at the beginning, because it's interesting and it's important. I know the program is in Daba, the walking towards knowledge, and so the program is actually oriented, from what I've been able to gather, to putting out certain perspectives for people of African descent. I mean, I can see that from what Dr. Fergus was saying and some of the other stuff I've heard in the past. So we need to reflect, first of all, that CL Financial was the largest conglomerate ever built in the region. And it was the largest conglomerate ever built in the region, and was also built largely by people of African descent. So we need to put that on the record very clearly and very firmly and very simply.
Well, let's just spend a minute now,
sure,
talking about the,
sure,
history of CL Financial.
Mm-hmm. Let's do that.
Going back to the early part of the 20th mm-hmm. century, around mm-hmm. the same time that the guys from Stingo were beating everybody at,
yes,
wicket.
Yeah.
And there were, you know, yeah, some local football,
yeah,
clubs.
It was a moment of revolutionary flux between the trade unions, between the sporting movements.
Tell us how it began. Tell us
and
how it began quickly.
What actually happened is that Mr. Dupri, who was 37 years old at the time. So it's important for us to get this fact also out there, that Mr. Dupri, and that's Mr. Cyril Dupri, which is the elder who followed, who preceded Mr. Lawrence Dupri. Mr. Dupri started his company at the age of 37. And his colleague, we're going to talk about Pan-Africanism tonight, and we're going to talk about Pan-Africanism within the Caribbean and Pan-Caribbean thinking, and we're going to talk about it in relation to the Federation. And his colleague, his riding partner, as we say in today's lexicon, his riding partner, was a fellow called Cyril Monsanto. There were two Cyrils. And Cyril Monsanto was about the same age as Lawrence, as a Cyril, a little older than Cyril Dupri, and was a Lucian. He was a St. Lucian, mm-hmm, in Trinidad. They'd met up in America and decided to give this thing a go. So, in fact,
they were doing insurance sales.
They were doing different things in America,
and they decided to come and try it.
They
set up their own,
yeah,
thing in Trinidad.
It was a very brave thing. And it was brave on two levels. It was brave because you were really taking on a situation where the country was still a colony. And the big insurance and banking companies, the big finance companies, were foreign owned and dominated by white people because it was a colonial order. Okay, so there was that issue of trust. Could our people, the people in the country, the black and the brown people, trust another black or brown person with their pennies and their shillings and their investments? So it was a question of building trust. And then there's also the question of the name. You know, part of the tradition, we talk about the African tradition and Pan-Africanism and so on. Part of the tradition is what name you give something. And the name has a tremendous significance. Now, my view, I've written it and I've said it before, my view is that the choice of the name colonial is actually pregnant with meaning. Because in today's world, the word colonial is almost like a curse. So you could say to somebody, well, Bob, I find the way you're looking at this is colonial. Yeah. And you're really telling Bob he's talking stupidness. But at that time, and we have to look at words in their time and their meaning. At that time, the word colonial meant the dark-skinned subjects of the British Empire. So when people in London in the 30s and the 40s were complaining about the colonials coming to live here, they weren't complaining about the Australians and the New Zealanders and the Canadians. Mm-hmm. You understanding me? They weren't complaining about the white South Africans. They were complaining about the darkies, the people of African and East Indian and brown people and so on. Mm-hmm. So in fact, the word colonial at that time...
So that's how you think it was utilized?
That's my belief. And yeah. I'm putting it out
I
there.
I remember that the first saying of the company, you know, was save, brother, save.
Yes, and at that time it was equivalent as I've written. It was equivalent to somebody starting a finance company today. Let's suppose myself and Chabaka Kambon were to try and start a finance company next week, and to name it the Nubian Savings Institution, or the Yoruba Savings Institution. It was tantamount
bold
to that.
Like that.
It was bold like that. That. So yes. It was bold financially to go into the water against the sharks. Mm-hmm. And it was bold on a level, on a conceptual level, in terms of what it was named.
And now let me just ask you a question now, because this company, as you said, became the largest financial institution, not just in Trinidad and Tobago, but in the Caribbean.
Yeah, the largest conglomerate in the region.
Even while this institution was the largest conglomerate in the region, people were boldly saying that Africans didn't know anything about business and they couldn't do business. How did that happen? How do you think those two things were able to coexist?
Well, many times things coexist. So, for example, we still have we have all kinds of bizarre coexistences, because we have colonial remnants in our souls and our bloodstream, and sometimes it's in the air and the water. It's all around us, you know. But in fact, at that time, and I want to tell you a little story. Cyril Dupree was trying to motivate his salesmen, and his salesmen were having a hard time. And some of the research I did, one of them was telling a story. I think his name was Kangali. It might have been George Kangali was the fellow's name, one of the early salesmen. And he was telling the story about what a hard time they had. People would slam their windows in their faces, other black people. Because what does a black man know about selling insurance? Insurance is for white people and for the people, the big buildings in town and so on. They had a little office in Queen Street. Mm-hmm. And they persisted and they fought. And Cyril, in fact, to encourage his sales force, actually said to them, well, I know I think you all have this thing wrong. I'm going to try to quote it from memory. He said, no, I think you all have this thing wrong. Of course, we understand that the Creole man, at that time, the word Creole was a code word for the man of color. Mm-hmm. We understand that the Creole man would always have a difficulty with giving business to another Creole man. We understand that. But in fact, I believe that if you give a man value, and if you give a man service, that person will give you business and they will come back to you. And I intend to give our customers both. And it is on those principles, which are extremely exemplary, that CL Financial grew out of Clico. Those are the founding principles and the bedrock the company was built on. A situation of trust, a situation of service, a situation of value. Adding value in today's MBA speak. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. So these are the kind of formidable foundations of the empire. Indeed. Very interesting.
Indeed. So bring us forward now to the to the more contemporary period.
Well, I want to say one little pin
before we get to collapse.
Before I get there, one little pin to say that in 1962, when the company had its 25th anniversary, and that was at Queen's Hall, the celebration of Queen's Hall was a new building, and the keynote speaker was the then Premier. It was 1961, I'm sorry. The keynote speaker was the then Premier, which was Dr. Eric Williams. He became Prime Minister a little while later. Mm-hmm. And one of the key passages from Williams' speech on that occasion was that the people who founded this company must have had it in their hearts and their minds that they were doing this company not just for Trinidad and Tobago, but for the Caribbean region, and with a vision in their hearts and their minds of the Federation of the West Indies. That's the consciousness that fueled the thing, because they had branches through the Caribbean. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Guyana, Barbados, St. Lucia, so it's a very interesting story.
There's something you might want to look into now that you know, Dr. Tony Martin has passed.
Yes.
But just before he passed, he was here on Indaba, and he pointed out that some of Dupre's partners, he was able to, in his research, he had discovered that in the letters that they wrote between themselves, this is Cyril Dupre, the father now, not the junior.
Yeah, Cyril Dupre, the older one.
That some of them used African names.
Really?
Yeah, they had their so-called Christian or European names, which they used publicly. But when they wrote to each other in private correspondences, they were writing each other as Kwame and all kind of things.
It reminds me of my days. But of course, I never had one of those names because I had one of these ones from the time I was born.
Anyway,
yeah.
So let's come.
So we're coming up to the current situation.
Current period.
You know, now what is happening is that the group grew into something that we call CL Financial, and it was a model, and that model was one in which they abused the savings of the people from Clico, principally,
yes,
to make a diverse range of investments, policyholders and so on.
Right,
and those investments would have been energy related. We talked about methanol holdings. There were substantial real estate investments, home construction. There were investments in finance. So they bought Republic Bank. There was a bit of after a tremendous fight to get control of Republic Bank. And of course, there was liquor because there was the Angostura and the foreign liquor companies that Mr. Dupre and his team invested in. So there was it was quite a diverse portfolio of things. But ultimately, It seems that it was a kind of a cruel twist. Ultimately, the group had marketed itself as being masters of the universe where investment was concerned, because that is the center of the whole thing. You put your money with them because they know more about money than you.
Right.
You don't know what to do with money. They do. So you put your money with them, and they give you they gave a handsome return. They paid higher interest rates than other people in the marketplace, and so on. And therefore, whatever they were doing In the local parlance, they must be know what they're doing, because whatever they were doing, they were paying me more than Scotia,
they're
paying me more than Republic, they're paying me more than FCB, so they must be know what they're doing, and every year I get my thing and so on. And ultimately, that model, the model of funding the group through high interest, low short-term borrowings, because that's what it was. When you took out an EFPA, it was 1 year or 2 years, so they were short-term loans that you were making to the company. They were doing long-term investments with short-term borrowings at very high interest. And that kind of model, in terms of financial architecture, is a model that is really, really a risky model. And they came undone.
Yes.
I don't believe, there have been some people who try to promote the notion, listeners, I don't believe that, in fact, there is any truth to the notion that the events on Wall Street in 07 and 08 precipitated a particular crisis that caused them to go down. I don't believe that. Yeah. They had very small exposure.
So you wouldn't say that they were using the same types of business models, that you know, the same approach to finance that was being used at the time in Wall Street, that we are seeing starting to come back into vogue these days, and people are talking about potential future crashes. You're not seeing, is it not?
Well,
can we not characterize it that way?
No. There are, because those companies out there are investing in, so they're taking financial investments and investing it in further financial investments. That's how I read what happened on Wall Street. And it became bizarre that people invented products, and they were even products that weren't really products, and they called them synthetic products.
Right.
It was as crazy as that. I mean, it's beyond the scope of this interview.
Okay.
But they did. But whereas these people, the Lawrence Dupre team.
Yeah. Based on your investigation, it was a straightforward case of solid things.
So Angostura is a solid thing. Yes? Home construction actually had land. They were solid things. But you overpay for things, and the way you finance it was set up the wrong way, and they got into problems.
This is
how come we got the collapse of the group.
Okay, so the group collapses.
In the beginning of 09.
And tell us what happens. Who's in power and what happens at
that time, Mr. Manning was in power, and his team, the people in the cabinet included Mariano Brong, Dr. Rowley was not in the cabinet, for those people who keep trying to say that Dr. Rowley this and Dr. Rowley that. Dr. Rowley had been fired in April of 08 by Mr. Manning for a whole lot of things that were the Cola Heart thing and the Napa and a whole lot of stuff. Mr. Imbert, who's the Minister of Finance, he was in the cabinet, and so on. So a number of people who are currently, Mr. Manning has passed on, of course, but a number of people who are currently still in the corridors of power were in cabinet when this thing went down. Mm-hmm. Mr. Mariana Brong is no longer in the corridors of power, but of course he's a respected banker.
And how did they treat it?
Well, this is interesting. At the time,
you say the government gave them a blank check.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought you were going to say blah, yes. But you said blank check. It's so funny, huh? The way the light in the studio is. The way you're
I left to a cave in there. That's a blah.
It's blah you were going
to say. Right.
But seriously, what happened was this. The public was told that we have to bail this company out because the stability of this company is important for the financial stability of the whole society.
Too big to fail.
Correct. This is something that we have to do. What we're realizing now is that too big to go to jail, but my motto is that it's too big to hide. So we're going to keep pumping this. It's too big to hide. Coming back to the point, what they did, they gave them a deal where, in fact, they kept their shares. In the foreign countries, they gave up their shares, and they kept their shares. They were to borrow up to $5 billion. That's what the public was told in January of 2009.
$5 billion or 5 million?
Billion. They were to borrow $5 billion from the Treasury. And that money didn't have any interest rate named. We now know that some interest was attached to that money, a very low rate of interest. I would say criminally low in terms of what the circumstances were. You can't have a distressed borrower borrowing money on better terms than somebody who has a thriving business. And in fact, the money that was lent, that first $5 billion was lent at a rate of interest 4.75%. And the prevailing rate of interest at that time, I've checked the central bank figures, the prevailing rate of interest at that time in the country, the commercial bank's rate of interest. So if you had a business that was doing well and you needed to borrow money from the bank, and you approach all the banks in the country, the average rate of interest you would get to borrow that money for your thriving business was about 11%. Whereas a collapsed business was able to borrow our money, our taxpayers' money, for less than half that. So this is why I describe it as a criminal rate of interest. These are my comments. These are my views. I have an opinion.
Okay? But interesting. Let me just for the sake of the listener who's now getting introduced to this subject, who's just hearing your voice for the first time.
Sure.
He would have heard you speak with great pride and admiration about the company and its founder.
Yes.
And, you know, and its, you know, its achievements. And now, hearing you speak with great disdain about the bailout of this company, how do you make that, how do you explain that to the listener?
Well, you know, you have a very interesting question about sense here. And I think that this is an example of economic and financial injustice, and I will go back to the roots of the bailout. So the $5 billion, I'll tell you what I mean. The $5 billion that was lent in the first place, what we were told, was to rescue the stability of the system and so on. Here we are. What is it? 8 years later. 8 years plus later. 8.5 years later. The last time Mr. Imbert spoke at the mid-year budget review, it was on the 10th of May this year. And Mr. Imbert gave us a figure, an estimated figure of $27.7 billion. That's where I get the $4 billion US from. Has been spent on this. You have $27.7 billion that has been spent. And yet, check this out. You have groups. You have the Peter Permell Group. You have the Ramesh Lawrence Maharaj Group. You have groups of people, thousands of people who haven't received their money. So who got the money? Who? What is this really happening here?
When you say 27 million,
27.7 billion.
You mean disbursed to shareholders? Or
I don't know what he means. You'll have to ask Mr. Imbert that. But that's what he said. It's on the record. It's on the public record.
So you're saying that what started out as a check for $5 billion US, right? Correct?
TT.
$5 billion TT turned out to be 27.7 billion TT.
Correct.
Right? And you have been trying to find out
where
all that money went.
Exactly. And this is the point, because here we have a situation. Let me show you. Let's walk through it again. We have to walk through it several different ways to see the size of it. It's like an elephant in your room. You have to go on one side and feel the ears and feel the trunk and feel different parts of the creature. We were told $5 billion in the beginning of 2009. By the end of 2009, we were being told it would be about $10 billion. By the time the partnership won the election in May of 2010, and they presented their first budget on the 8th of September 2010, and there was a furor because Mr. Dukoran was cutting back the bailout. And Kamla gave a big speech, Kamla Prasad Bisesa, the Prime Minister at the time, gave a big speech on the 1st of October 2010. And the Prime Minister at the time, pardon me, was very clear. And let's talk about it. She said, from the records we have seen, $7.3 billion has been spent. And to sort this out, we need another $7 billion. So the country needs to spend about $14.3 billion to sort all this thing and pay everybody. And the question she had for the PNM people, who on the other side are arguing with her, is you are here arguing with me about the small man and the poor man and the trade unionist and the pensioner. So who got the 7.3? You see it? If the reason for the bailout in the first place was to protect the pensioner and to protect the poor man,
well,
to protect the small man. Hold on, and let me finish. So in October 2010, we were at an official estimate from the highest level of government, the Prime Minister at the time, of 14.3. We are now at an estimate of 27.7. Are you understanding what I'm saying?
Yes, and now let me just clarify for the sake of our listeners. Sure, please clarify this for the sake of our listeners. But having spent 27.7 billion, has the company been rescued and everything been brought? Is everything running smoothly now?
No, because they were in the High Court about 2 weeks ago and they were able to get an order from the High Court. As far as I'm reading, I'm not a lawyer, but as far as I was able to read what appeared in the press, I would like to see the ruling. But they were able to get an order from the High Court to have the company liquidated. And that order would not be granted unless the company was insolvent. And the company could only be insolvent if it couldn't pay its debts. And a company that can't pay its debts. You see how interesting it is? So it hasn't been rescued. It hasn't been rescued. So
27.7 million dollars have just disappeared.
Was paid to we don't know who.
Okay, but let's go back now to your lawsuit.
Yes.
You sued the government.
Yes.
Successfully.
Correct.
Back in 2015.
Yes. I sued them.
And you sued them for what? What was the
information?
Right.
So unlike all the other lawsuits.
And you win. So where's the information?
Well, it took me to the appeal court. So I won the case on the 22nd of July of 2015. I won the case on the 22nd of July 2015. And the High Court awarded me all the items of information I was asking for. And there were three items of information I was asking for. Mm-hmm. Number one, I wanted the audited accounts of the group. If I could not get the audited accounts, I wanted to get whatever estimates or unaudited or management accounts the various ministers of finance had been using. Because since this whole thing is going on 8 years, various ministers of finance get up and give us speeches and they call figures of this and they call figures of that. I want to know what they're reading. Whatever they're reading, I want that.
Right.
Or the audited account. That was the first element. The second element was, pardon me, the second element was that there was a briefing to independent senators carried out at the highest level. It was carried out by the then Minister of Finance, Mr. Winston Dukoran, and the then Governor of the Central Bank, Mr. Ewart Williams. Mr. Dukoran is now in Canada doing some academic work, and Mr. Ewart Williams is now the economic advisor to Mr. Imbert. Those two people led the delegation, those two high public officials led the delegation that briefed the independent senators in an attempt to get their votes for two important laws they were passing to progress the bailout. I wanted all the details of that briefing to our parliamentarians. I wanted to see what was the text, what were the graphs, what were the tables, what were the charts. I wanted that briefing. And the third thing I asked for, and the High Court awarded me all these things. The third thing I asked for, pardon me, I wanted to get the names of who got all that money and the dates of when they got the money. So Shabaka Cambon got checks twice. Shabaka Cambon.
No, you shouldn't even say that on the radio, you know, because you know it is. We have some detractors out there. Detractors out there. You know, that man will hear the wrong thing tonight.
You are speaking hypothetically. You're speaking hypothetically.
Right, just clarify. Just clarify. Just clarify.
Yeah, just a general example. The point is that the third thing was to get the names and the dates of when people received payments. So that in fact we'd be able to have a listing.
So they took it up, they appealed, and then what happened?
Well, they've appealed it. The Minister of Finance at the time was Mr. Hawaii. He ran into the court on the 10th of August and they lodged an appeal. And of course, shortly thereafter, on the 7th of September 2015, Dr. Rowley and his team won the national election. So the People's Partnership were no longer in power. Mr. Imbert became the Minister of Finance. And of course, the day that he took office, I wrote him. And I said to him, sir, you just won an election on accountability, transparency, and good governance. This case is a total disgrace in terms of a failure to account, be transparent, or exhibit good governance.
Mm-hmm.
Publish the information. I have a High Court ruling. Withdraw your appeal, please, and publish this information. And cutting a very long story short, which is kind of tedious, we were in contact with each other. Mr. Imbert and I engaged each other without getting into the details. And the current government has continued the appeal. So the appeal of the current administration...
They had a choice to drop it.
Yes. They continued the appeal. And the appeal of the current administration, which is the state, just in terms of law, is the state is appealing against my ruling, was lodged in the high appeal court on Friday the 30th of December 2016. It was the last working day of the year. They lodged a full appeal. They have a powerful team led by Mr. Russell Martino and a whole lot of luminary people and so on. It's a very heavy team. I have a heavy team too. And we're going down fighting. Because this is a matter of the first importance. We cannot have a situation in our country, in our republic. We just celebrated Republic Day. We cannot have a situation in our country where 27.7 or 23 or 25, take your pick. We cannot have a situation in our country where over $20 billion of public money is spent. And you are telling me, as a matter of law and public administration, you can't tell me who got that money?
Yeah.
That is completely against the fundamental functioning of a republic. We cannot have that in this country. And I want to say it's a question of economic and social justice at its root. Because we have a situation where we don't have enough toilet paper in the hospital. We have a situation where we don't have enough soap in the hospital. I'm talking about the public hospital. People listening know what I'm talking about. So you don't have enough toilet paper. You don't have enough soap. But you have enough money to find from somewhere in your back pocket to bail out the richest man in the Caribbean on an interest-free thing. Because you only paid interest on the first $5 billion. The rest of it was interest-free.
You've rested. Your research is...
It's interest-free. That's
for my clarification, since it's only information that you requested and that the High Court would have granted, was that done under the Freedom of Information
Correct.
Act?
Correct. I did proceed under the Freedom of Information Act. That's right.
So the appeal, if the government, the state's appeal is successful, how would that impact the Freedom of Information Act going forward?
Well, it'll be. I would like to say that question of yours is extremely valuable. I would like to say that it'll be an unacceptable situation, because what we're really facing in this country is a situation where people could say that we are relying on the CL Financial precedent set by the appeal court to not release this information or that information on public expenditure. And one of the raging issues in this country, it doesn't seem to matter who you elect, who you put in power. And I don't want any of the current crop of politicians who are listening to this to feel downhearted, but I'm just giving it to you the way I see it. It doesn't seem to matter who you elect. There seems to be a prevalent problem in the country of corruption, a perception of corruption, a perception of officials enriching themselves and so on. And it is underlying a lot of the feelings of resentment that exist in the country, okay, regardless of who you elect. So, and I know that efforts are being made, but the reality is that this perception is very, very real. And from my point of view, I find it difficult to be very frank and straightforward. I find it difficult to accept these notions that we are about accountability, transparency, and good governance, and you want to conceal the figures the Minister of Finance is relying on. You want to conceal the briefing that the sitting Minister of Finance and the sitting Governor of the Central Bank gave to our parliamentarians to obtain their vote. And you want to conceal the names of the people who received the $27.7 billion. My fundamental belief is that effort, those strenuous efforts at concealment and suppression, are incompatible with the notion that you are about accountability, transparency, or good governance. I will believe it. You have to walk the talk.
Well, Afra, it seems to me that you are you're in the right, and that I don't know, Dr. Fergus, but it is my belief that justice will win out eventually.
Well, yeah,
I cannot be so optimistic in this country. No. I'm telling you seriously.
You have another view. Go on, give it to us.
No, because there seems to be a culture here that has total contempt for what we may think is obvious and a natural course of action. The law states something quite clearly, and yet you find that state authorities, including police and so on, total disdain for the law, even the law, the letter of the law. And I cannot see, I just cannot be that optimistic. I hope it happens, but I can't be. And that's because quite often we set up institutions, checks and balances, watchdog institutions that have no teeth, that have no executive authority and so on, and can always and easily be overruled. And that's part of our problem.
Yeah.
You see, I recall, as corrupt as we often dub, you know, some African country, Nigeria in particular, I recall when Nigeria set up the Financial and Economic Crimes Commission.
Yes.
And gave them power.
I know.
The kind of power that our Integrity Commission and so on lack completely.
Yeah.
And in no time at all, once you heard the Financial and Economic Crimes Commission investigating you, make preparation for yourself to make sure, because you're going to get arrested. You're going to go to jail. And I think they had their own jails and so on,
of
too.
Of course, yeah.
And you certain governors were arrested.
Yeah.
You know, people at that level of the state would have been arrested, charged, and you know. But in Trinidad, this does not happen. It's as if, you know, we are one of the cleanest countries in the world where corruption is concerned. Nobody goes before the court. To start with, not even to say that get locked up, nobody goes before the court.
But
I am not that optimistic. Yeah.
All you have to do is spend a few months out of the country.
Yeah,
then you come back cool as ever.
My mind can change, but I need to see results before it changes.
Okay,
let me
make a further point, because I want to take the opportunity, and again, I thank you for the opportunity to present these perspectives this evening. Let me make the opportunity to make two further points.
Let me just open the phone lines. Let me just say that the phone lines will be open after you finish.
Okay, these 2 points, and I'll
it's 6224911, and then we're going to take calls right to the top of the hour.
Sure. The first point is that when CL Financial is being run by Mr. Dupree and Mr. Montai, the chiefs of CL Financial at the time before the collapse, whatever we think about them or whatever we say about them, the fact is they publish audited accounts every year. So they were annual audited accounts. The last year for which they were audited accounts was the year ending 31st of December 07. Now, since the state took control on the 30th of January 09 to now, the whole audited accounts have stopped. So we have to really look at it and ask ourselves if CL Financial is behaving like one of those big state enterprises that never publishes accounts. You see? So we have to just look at it soberly and ask ourselves why, if Mr. Dupree could publish it and Mr. Montai and them could publish it, and a picture is being painted that they're the bad guys, they're the ones who wrecked the company and so on and so on. Well, okay, that might be so, but why can't you publish them? You've been in control of everything for the last 8.5 years. You've had all the money, you've had lawyers and accountants. Second point I want to make is that there's a Caribbean dimension to this that is not discussed enough. I discussed it in two articles recently.
Let me just say that you seem to be suggesting there's a lot more
plenty
going on here than meets the eye.
We don't have enough time, but we're just touching on things going through. Let me make the second point about the Caribbean element of this, the Caribbean aspect. The Caribbean aspect of this is extremely important to understand. The group built itself by harvesting the savings and the investments of people who made investments in insurance policies and those EFPAs and so on. And those people were making investments through Clico Investment Bank and British American throughout the Caribbean. And therefore, the savings of Guyanese people, Bajan people, people in the Eastern Caribbean, people in the Bahamas, people in Belize, the region that we know as the Caribbean littoral, those people's savings built the group. They played a substantial part in funding all of those different types of companies I described. Mm-hmm. What is striking and painful is that, in fact, in much of the discussion that has gone on from the political quarters, and I'm not focusing on Dr. Rowley at the moment, but including the people who went before, mm-hmm, as well as Mr. Dupree and his people who have been trying to get back the company. And they were trying to get back the company, and recently they took up a mantle of saying, well, in fact, it's a black company, and it's a pity if a black government was to wreck a black company by liquidating it. That sort of discussion started.
They
started
any kind of rap now.
Yeah.
But the point, for a while, they didn't really.
But the point I'm making is that, in fact, neither side has made any attempt to address the claims of the Caribbean investors. And from my research, which I put in the papers about a month ago, those claims could amount to something like $3.7 billion. So when we talk about a settlement or we talk about a liquidation action in the High Court, we're not actually getting an attempt or a proposal for how we settle the claims of our Caribbean brothers and sisters. And I don't believe that we could have a proper settlement of this unless we settle those claims. Quickly, I'll just say the four things we need to have, in my opinion, to have a decent settlement of this would be, number one, the fit and proper rules need to be applied. The people who wrecked the company need to be disqualified from any further participation. Number two, the money that was borrowed, we need to find some way to get some interest on that money. Number three, the Caribbean element must be addressed. The Caribbean element, in terms of settling the claims of the Caribbean people, must be addressed. And number four, we must have a situation in which the company pays back all the money that it owes to the taxpayers of Trinidad and Tobago. So I'd leave it there. Take calls.
Yes, 6224911. That's the number to call if you want to be part of the conversation.
Yes,
I know
we
we've been
have
trying
a
to get.
On the line.
Yes. Good night. Yes. Welcome to Indaba.
Yes. Thank you. Listen, when this whole debacle started, I was under the impression that a bailout was what was needed for the economic stability, not of only of the company but of the entire economy of Trinidad and Tobago. Somehow it was tied into that.
Yeah,
sort
that was
of a thing.
Yeah.
Right? Now, I'm measuring this bailout, the effect it is having, and the bailout as applied in the U.S., where I understand these people pay back their money and thing, and they're going ahead good. What seems to be at a mist there, and does monies, now I'm hearing that these monies were already paid, does that have to do with our current economic situation, whether it was a good move, bad move, what it is went on there? And then this talk shop that we had today, right, and all these sort of things, is that just the food that to confuse the issue to the average person, so they get more muddled up in the mire and they don't understand, and so they just disqualify the population and say, look, all they don't understand this, so whatever we do, what is going on?
Okay, the first question about whether it's got a relationship, the CL financial bailout has got a relationship, and I would say the mismanagement of the bailout has got a relationship with the current economic straits. Well, it's not a direct relationship, because the current economic straits, as far as I understand it, is due in large part to a collapse in the country's earnings. Okay, having said that, one thing we can say for sure is that Trinidad and Tobago, our treasury, needs to get back that money. We need to get back that money with interest. We need to get back that money in a timely fashion. So there is a connection. The second question about the talk shop today, I don't know. I wasn't really focused on it, so I can't really make any detailed comment on that. There was an attempt by the government to engage people in a discussion about the economic situation, and it was mostly, I think it took most of the day, but I was busy working, so I didn't focus on it really.
All right. We take another call. 6224911. Welcome to Indaba.
Hi, good day. In regards to the economic climate for Trinidad and Tobago, wouldn't it be fair to say that we need to start moving forward towards a more technological-based society? So say, for example, we've been training students who have been studying for, how would you say, we've been paying them for about 10 years, 12 years worth of education, right, for free. Why not utilize that? Why not utilize them? We have a huge resource of human resource that's sitting down doing nothing. We could utilize them one way or another, outsourcing our skills and services to other countries, acting like an outsource studio like India and all those other countries. Why not? It's one of the ways that we can diversify our economy right now to make some cash, because right now we're strapped, and that's one of the best ways right now as it stands to make some form of foreign revenue. Would that be good?
Well, I think some of those operations already exist, huh? The sort of call centers and so on, they're not heavily publicized, but some of them already exist in the country. How much employment they actually provide and at what wages, those are questions that the trade union comrades would have to weigh in on, and in fact on what terms that are our people employed. And more to the point, if the operation is one that reaps a benefit, if it adds value, how much of that value added actually stays in the country apart from the wages? So it's an important point to consider, but I don't know any more than that.
Yeah, I just you know, sometimes though I'm a little concerned when we start to talk about you know, putting our emphasis in certain areas that exclude the humanities. I don't know if Dr. Ferguson want to comment on that. There seems to be a drive to not just here but across the globe, in fact, you know, in the most developed countries, you know, led by the United States of America, to move away from the humanities entirely, and And it there is a very serious, there's a conversation taking place about the pros and cons of such a move. Some, you know, something that we'd have to talk about on another program.
Yeah, the more you talk about technology, the less you would see a role for the humanities. Huh? I think basically that is what happens. Not that they're incompatible, but, you know, that is how it is.
Well, is that so? Because let me just throw something here. I mean, this is coming off topic, but I just have to throw this one out there. We have companies like Amazon or Netflix that quite simply didn't exist 20 years ago. And they're some of the hugest companies on the planet. And what we have happening is something that I don't think anybody really ever predicted. Is that Amazon and Netflix are now producing TV shows that are movie quality, movie length, that involve, I would say in rejoinder to you, Dr. Fergus, substantial investment in the humanities to make best use of the technologies.
I said they're not incompatible.
Yeah. That's what's happening now. I didn't hear that.
Yeah, no, that's what I said. Yeah. That they are not, I said, people tend to think they are, but they are not incompatible.
Yeah, but I'm saying that we have real examples of that
but
happening
now.
But
we have to find out how, you know, to pull the things together. No, I agree there's a potential there, and it's a realizable potential.
Yeah, well, I misheard you. I don't want to sound like any politician, but I misheard.
Yeah, but incredible revelations on tonight's program of Indaba. $27.7 billion spent in what started out as a bailout for CL Financial. I don't know how you would justify after what, the $14 billion.
Yes.
You know, what the rest of the money went for. It's all a big mystery.
Yes.
And Brother Afra Raymond is describing this as a issue of social
and economic justice.
In this country. Paramount, in your opinion, Doctor? Brother Raymond.
Yes, it really is a paramount issue. And what's sad is that we have a situation in the country where our educated classes, and I regard it as a civilizational crisis. Our educated classes have not spoken out on this. So we have, let me tell it to you straight. We're sitting here in 2017. We've never had more economists in Trinidad and Tobago. We've never had more chartered accountants. We've never had more attorneys. We've never had more people qualified in banking. We've never had more people. I'm going to finish what I'm going to say, and I'm telling you.
We've never had more journalists.
It's a complete chilling silence. And we talk about freedom of expression. We talk about a chilling effect on freedom of speech. Well, a chilling effect on freedom of speech could come about from a civilizational crisis. And I regard this as a civilizational crisis that somebody like me, who is not an accountant, an economist, a banker, or an attorney, could be leading voice in this. Who is the leading? And apart from people fighting to get back their money.
Yes.
Like these, all the other lawsuits, it's people fighting to get back their money. Yeah?
Right.
But the public interest case, which should have been advanced, has sat fallow. And where are all those people?
Let me ask you, have you tried to form a coalition? Have you tried to approach certain people, perhaps, who you think might have the capacity to?
I used to, but I stopped.
Yeah.
Because what is happening, this thing is so big, you know, at the beginning of the program, you made a point about too big to fail, which is that really pregnant.
Yeah, well,
phrase.
It's one, you know, I incorporated from.
But it has failed, right? America, because these guys have filed for bankruptcy and insolvency.
Yeah, the court awarded them an order to liquidate the company, and that means the company is insolvent. But really.
So CLECO is over.
I think so. But that doesn't mean that there might be parts.
Yes, parts.
You can take out and sell this part and take out and sell that part and detach things from each other, which is what a liquidator does.
And companies might
emerge and buy a portfolio of this or a portfolio of that. There
may
be other things coming out.
The thing that happened today, which you said you were not privy to, certainly today was the day that the Prime Minister and other persons within the government met with people representing different groups. I mean, Ruvidere Victor said he was part of the group that was talking. The union people were invited to be part of the discussion, and they opted out.
Yeah, I heard so.
Okay, so then post that, there was a post cabinet meeting.
Yes.
Today would have been the formal day for the post cabinet meeting. So the Prime Minister and Mr. Imbert were talking with the press today, and they were asked several questions. One of the questions was, could you give us an update on what's happening with the CLECO buyout?
Okay.
And both the Prime Minister and Mr. Imbert said, you know, well, we prefer to, well, one reinforce what the other one was saying, we prefer to speak about this on Monday, the budget day, right? So something should happen on budget day. They kept being asked that question, you know, in different ways, and of course, Dr.
So
Rowley.
It could be a surprise.
Could be a surprise.
But it's a pleasant one. This is what I said.
Brother Raymond, finally,
I know you're going to wrap up. Might it be possible that a declared bankruptcy could be a strategy to cover the tracks from this this corruption that
it could be discovered? It could be. That's a big
possibility. Because bankruptcy is a way... Well, in the United States, you know, for people not to make certain claims. But in this, in within our own polity, could it be that the company is declared bankrupt and therefore it might be more difficult or people might lose interest in pursuing, you know, the tracks of these $27 million?
That could be what's happening. I mean, I don't know. It's difficult to tell because we get very sporadic reports. For example, I have not... Maybe I need to go and look closely, but I've not been able to see yet the ruling of the court in that matter. I'm trying to get hold of the liquidator's report. The provisional liquidator makes monthly reports. He made one a few weeks ago. I'd like to have a look at that. But certainly, a wrapping up of the whole thing, winding up on liquidation, could well be a way that a lot of the concerns I have could be extinguished, because my own appeal court case comes up on the 24th of January of 2018. Okay? So, in fact, by the time we get to there, things could have shifted so much that certain things may no longer be available. We'll see. I mean, I'm going to continue fighting.
Yes, you know? And we want to salute you, Afra, and we want to stand in solidarity with you and give you courage, and we want you to continue to update us on this matter as you see fit.
Thank you.
And we will share the information with our publics here on Indaba, the place where knowledge grows. This is indeed an issue of social and economic justice, as you have put it, and something we must pay attention.
I want to close by thanking you all for the opportunity, Shabaka and Dr. Fergus and Radio 91.1 FM Talk City. And I want to say that my work could be found in one location at afroraymond.net. All the work is there. I've got all the articles. I've got the background material. I've got the TV videos. I've got the radio. Hopefully you'll give me a recording of this. I put that up on the website as well. I archive all my work and I curate it there. So all of the work is there. And it's not only CL Financial. I cover a range of other issues. So thanks again for the opportunity.
Indeed. And we would hope that you'd come back and have another conversation with us sometime soon about corruption in general. But again, we want